as you know, a great deal of discussion about Mars these days. This is the data in graphical form from the Mars Surveyor magnetometer on day 278. Spacecraft is in a very elliptical orbit when this data was taken, and you see two spikes of the magnetometer arrayed on this graph, here and here. This is an actual global view of Mars with that tremendous dichotomy. Weird stuff in the southern hemisphere and basically very flat plains, the bottoms maybe of ancient oceans in the northern hemisphere. Canyon, this rift, this incredible crack, which in Tom's model could be when the stuff slammed into the other side, this crack opened up because the planet literally split, like hitting an orange on one side and the shockwave that goes through to the other. What's interesting is that the magnetometer results show that there is very little, if any, global field. And what global field there is on Mars appears to be that of a corresponding planet or moon which spun very slowly in maybe a few days, not in 24 plus some odd minutes that Mars spins now. The second thing is that you have located around Mars these very interesting concentrations of magnetic flux. This is what the Mars Global Surveyor is now finding, that instead of a global dipole field, like a little bar magnet, a horseshoe magnet maybe, or a bar magnet, you have these localized regions of intense magnetic concentration. Intense is a relative term. And they are of different polarities. They have different orientations. And they're scattered around the planet, corresponding to the craters. Big craters, small craters. Exactly what you'd expect if Mars got smashed by a tremendous amount of debris and the impacting process created a plasma, and the plasma imprints a frozen magnetic field which then stays there as a fossil to be measured by our surveyor when ultimately millions of years later, or maybe 65 million years later, we wander by and begin to take readings. In other words, data set after data set after data set indicates that Mars is not the way we used to think it was, that something extraordinarily interesting and bizarre has happened. And this interesting and bizarre thing, which of course was a very elegant, implicit part of the model, ultimately is what caused huge impacts on Earth 65 million years ago, which detonated, you know, the atmosphere in many places, which left enormous scars in the surface, which are now found as fossil craters, and which obliterated over half of the species on the planet, and something like 90% of the life forms at that time, to be replaced. Remember, we went from the Cretaceous to the Tertiary, went from dinosaurs to little tiny guys that ultimately grew up to be big guys who sit in auditoriums and watch computer view graphs. So without this event, this extraordinary event, triggered perhaps by a physics run wild, we would not be standing and sitting here in this auditorium having this conversation. Or if we were, we might be inhabiting slightly larger bodies and have scales, etc., etc., etc. So these are non-trivial implications for what we're discussing. The whole genesis of the human line, the human species, may be this fork in the road caused by whatever caused the planets that Tom has elucidated to one day decide to blow up. Which brings me to Tom Bearden, because there is an extraordinary elegance of working as we have worked at Cydonia and being led to a stunning new physics, of being an astronomer, an expert in celestial mechanics, and figuring out one day that the solar system is a little more complicated and interesting than we thought it was, and being led to the necessity for a new physics to literally blow worlds apart. And now we have in our midst, gentlemen, distinguished engineer, nuclear engineer, former Army Lieutenant Colonel, who has worked, labored very hard in the vineyards to figure out the trail where physics went wrong so we can ultimately reconstruct how it can go right. And it's on the basis of Tom Bearden's work that I wrote, in essence, the hyperdimensional paper that appears on the web now. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague and a man whose vision is, light years beyond most other folks, Colonel Tom Bearden.
Thank you very much, Richard, and thank everybody for being here. It's a pleasure to be here. I've still got a little bit of that jet lag. But we're going to try to come down a little bit to Earth and hopefully then get back off Earth later tomorrow. But today I want to come down to things in the laboratory bench and into the models that we have for things on the laboratory bench that do extend out into space and see if we can gain some insight here as to some errors that were made and propagated throughout physics. Now, if our models are wrong and we're trying to apply an erroneous model to a problem where we keep asking questions, we're not going to get the right answers. So, as Einstein pointed out, one of the things we really should do is always question the model. There's no such thing as a perfect model. We make too many assumptions on the front end. But it sounds kind of dry and kind of boring and kind of silly to ask a question like, you know, what is time? What is mass? Blunt truth of it is, physics does not know what charge is, what time is, what mass is, what length is. None of these things. But they don't tell us that when they're teaching us in school. They come across as if we already have it all figured out and all we've got to do is wind up a few decimal places. Well, that's just not true. What we want to do is not chase the decimal places, but we want to chase the model itself, a little bit of its history, and find out what they actually put in it and what we ought to change today because we've learned a lot since then. Could I have the next slide, please? Basically, we will start in, you might say, physics, and particularly electrical physics. I'll throw in anti-gravity to you for free. That's not going to cost you anything. We'll throw in over-unity systems for you. We'll give you the theory of how they work. That is free. Won't cost you anything. We will explain what right now I think is the missing ingredients in cold fusion. And that won't cost you anything, but it will really stretch your imagination on what kind of waves we're actually dealing with. And then we'll try to turn to what this has to say about living systems, life, life on planets, and development of living systems, and what kind of scenario evolves for a living system that's also a technological animal. That is, it has a tool-using member, and it makes tools, and therefore has a technology, both for use to overcome its environment and in use against its own self-competition. Next slide, please. I think we've reached a momentous turn in history. I would like to paraphrase Churchill, and of course you recognize the phrase from World War II, but I'm rephrasing it a little bit in a paraphrase. The technology we have today, some of it known, some of it not known, I'll refer to some that's not known, I won't dwell on it. We have not reached the end, and we have not reached the beginning of the end. But I think, as Churchill said, we've reached the end of the beginning. And we're being propelled full tilt into the beginning of the end. Next slide, please. And it isn't the kind of direction that science gives you. These are basic subjects. I won't stand here to read those things to you. We'll give you cold fusion effect. I'll tell you about the use of some of these rather strange waves to give you a totally new kind of healing, and this was proven. I don't have to prove anything. It's sitting in the hard literature in France. All we have to do is get the people to redo the experiments. And we will then try to describe the living part, and I will open up the question of the last human state, and I'll leave that up to you, because I'm not trying to speak religion or your own personal philosophy. That's your personal business. I'm just simply opening the subject, and I'm going to leave it that way. Next slide, please. Well, science has a history of suppression. The worst enemy of science is organized science itself, and leading physicists of the world generally have always recognized that. in his day, the greatest physicist of the day, Max Planck, said, you know, basically the old guy's got to die out before you can ever have a new physics. It's as simple as that. It still is. Things go 50 years in the literature and are totally ignored. One paper that I'm talking quite seriously about is 1903. It's totally ignored to this day, and it's one of the most fundamental things in the entire literature. Many things are sitting on the shelf, parked in our scientific literature, never examined, never followed up, not in our present models. Some of them force revisions of many of our most fundamental thoughts. Next slide. Here is an example, for example, it goes all the way back to the 1800s, of something that laid fallow for 40-something years. People just didn't have a kinetic theory of gases and so forth spring full tilt and with sweet reason accept it. That's not what happened. 40-something years went by till the old guys who opposed it died. That's how you got that kind of physics. Many of the things you studied in your books in university, Wegener, who discovered the plates in the earth and the movements of the plates, the name Wegener was made the same word as fool, utter fool. People would say, oh, he's a Wegener, which means he's an utter fool. Anybody ever apologize to Wegener? Hell no, like the Cajun says. Next slide, please. And today, it's worse than ever. If you are a young fellow going to college, going to university, and you are curious, you know, scientists are supposed to be curious, don't be too curious. Unless you pay the freight and learn the subject the way it's taught to you and learn to apply it, you're not going to live and do well, and you're not going to get your doctorate, and neither is the professor who's teaching you and allowing you to do that. He's in a continuous game of putting in requests for money, proposals. Maybe one in eight he gets. If he can't fund his graduate students, or he can't fund his own research, and if he can't get his papers published in the literature, he's dead. He may as well go work in a butcher shop. And many of them do. So we have a thing in science where when we use a phrase like the standard model, we mean a little more than just people with sweet reason have come to this conclusion. They beat you on the head and take your job. You don't get tenure. You don't become a full professor. You don't get your papers published. Sorry, but that's the way it is. It's not so much a giant conspiracy as it is a dogma. But, you know, it's splitting hairs to go to make the difference. The end effect is the same thing. First, let's talk about what happened to electrodynamics. Now, Tesla, next slide, please. Tesla calls the present electrodynamics we have the most inexplicable aberration of the scientific mind that had ever been recorded in all of history. That did not endear him to the very few scientists, about three dozen all there were in those days, electrodynamicists, who were struggling to understand this stuff. But Tesla was right. He was not wrong. I wouldn't have said it that way. That's much too blunt. But he spoke the truth, and I hope to show you a few of the errors that we've just propagated, and nobody ever went back and changed. Next slide, please. Well, electric charge. First, we had a material ether, and then we didn't have a material ether. And the next thing was we didn't think we had an ether at all. So we had the ludicrous thing of a medium undergoing vibrations without a medium. A clothesline undergoing clothesline vibrations, but without a clothesline. Now, that's what's in electrodynamics today. Electric charge. Nobody knows what it is. Over on the right, I show you a good physicist saying, we really don't know what it is, but we know what it does. It's become very fashionable in physics to say, we don't ask the question what anything is. We ask the question what it does. Our business is not to find out what anything is. And I'm saying, well, then what are you doing? I want to know what the potential is. And quite frankly, I couldn't find anybody, and I asked some pretty good fellows, and the real good physicist would tell me he didn't know, couldn't define it exactly. Feynman will tell you he can't define it exactly. and he does so in his three volumes of physics. He tells you don't look for a definition of force. You ain't going to get none, like the Cajun said. So, charge, what in the world is electric charge? Well, I'm going to give you a little quick and dirty definition of electric charge. It's a piece of mass, whatever mass is, that's engaged in a violent energetic exchange with a vacuum. The vacuum is nothing in the world but a seething sea of raw energy. I don't have to prove that no more. Even the U.S. Patent Office has recognized it and issues patents recognizing the vacuum as a source of energy. So help me God, the mountain finally came to Mohammed. So nowadays, the vacuum, the energetic vacuum, which is only about 50 years old, been known for about 50 years, been proven for about 50 years, has finally been accepted. Remember that 50-year figure. Before we get something accepted in the ordinary science. Mass is, in fact, engaged in a very, charged mass, in a very violent exchange of energy with a vacuum. But it's a funny little exchange. It's a peculiar little bird. It's spinning. It has spin. Now, what it does is, it doesn't quite reflect all of that back, re-emit it all back as virtual particles. That's a particle that appears so fast and disappears so fast, you can't grab it individually, but lots of them make up all the forces that we have, if a whole bunch of them get together. They generate all the forces in nature, quantum field theory. So what we have is a little bit of these things, like an old spinning wheel. This is a crude analogy. Don't press it too far. But like a spinning wheel takes a little bit of the fibers from the cotton and weaves them into a long thread. This thing weaves some of these little bitty virtual particle changes into coherent changes, groups of coherence, which if they'll hit another particle will make an ordinary observable change, will translate the particle. What did I say with all that mess? I've got to speak two ways. Some people here are technical, some people are not. Non-technically, what I said is this thing absorbs a lot of energy, radiates most of it back in the same form, but some of it it puts out in the form that generates all the fields and all the potentials and all the energy in those fields and potentials that reach from that charge all the way out to space. Now, this has been known for 40 years in particle physics, both experimentally and theoretically. It doesn't appear in electrodynamics to this day. I have been accused, because I work in free energy systems that can permissibly go put out more energy than you yourself have to input. They don't put out more than they get in. They put in more than you input. They get the other from outside. Been accused of talking perpetual motion, as is every other scientist who's tried to study the area. You want to know who really believes in perpetual motion machines? Who teaches them from a platform? Every university in the Western world, every PhD in physics, every PhD in electrodynamics teaches that the electron and the proton create from nothing all the energy and all those fields that that source charge produces, reaching across the universe. Like the Cajuns say, man, in my wildest nightmare, I couldn't approach that many of them perpetual motion machines. So you want to know who really advocates perpetual motion machines? Ordinary science. The reason is they assume an inert vacuum. No place for them to get any energy. So that means they create it all. But they just call them the source charge, and the energy pours out, and it continues to pour out forever, never quits. But you can't produce an over-unity machine when you've got all kind of free pumps producing all this energy. It's ludicrous. If I gave you a free set of fire hoses and you couldn't produce any water to use, there'd be something wrong with your head. If the things were running water all the time and you claimed you couldn't find any water for free, goodness gracious. Next slide, please. This really is what's in electrodynamics, ladies and gentlemen, so help me goodness. The spin of a particle, we measure transverse waves. Yes, indeed we do. Our instruments measure transverse waves. And that's not at all what comes in from the vacuum. What our instruments measure is electron wiggles in the wires, like we're measuring in wires. Now, the electrons in the wire, look at the little bottom diagram there, are spinning. And ahead of them in the wire, they got all these other electrons pushing back on them. So they can't go that away. They got too much forcing back on them. And they're spinning, so they act like a little gyro, and they precess side to side, which they do mostly. That's in the textbook. Electrons move down the wire in the current at about 4 inches per hour in a nominal little old circuit. The signal goes down the wire, if it's inductance and capacitance free, it's the speed of light, and since it's really got a little bit of that, a little bit less than the speed of light down the wire. But electrons don't move like that. They move about 4 inches per hour. So the electrons move most of their movement side to side, and that's what our instruments measure, and that's what they detect, and that's indeed the detected measurement, transverse waves. And that's the reason together. If they really are little gyros, and they really are precessing, and all we're measuring is precession waves of the electrons, the restrained electrons, then we have just proven that the wave coming in from the vacuum, the perturbation from space that disturbed them, was longitudinal. Or else you got to throw out all gyro theory. And you got to throw out electron spin and a few dozen other things. So what we have done, when they started this business, the vacuum was considered to have mass in it everywhere. So whatever came into the wire was considered just to be fluid shaking, and all we were doing was measuring the shaking fluid as it came in from space. Very reasonable assumption for that time. After we found out better, we never changed a thing. We never changed a thing. Next slide, please. Oh, boy, now this is a good one. Maxwell's equations, of course, were highly restricted by Heaviside and a couple other folks. But Maxwell himself and Faraday made some enormous errors. They were legitimately made at the time. These were not diabolical. They're not a conspiracy at all. They were the best knowledge of the time. But today I want you to see how strange they are. Faraday thought that his lines of force were actual physical strings in this physical matter that filled all space, they thought. And so these physical strings, when there was a electromagnetic disturbance in the ether, what it was these strings. These were taut strings. These strings were twanging. And that's where the notion of the transverse wave in the ether came from. This Faraday is twanging strings. And Maxwell says, and I sort of paraphrase the quote, I set about to capture exactly the thinking of Faraday. Now, he did have to replace those strings with tubes, taut tubes of force, but that's pretty close to strings. And so the whole notion of transverse electromagnetic waves in space is based on twanging strings, and so help me God, all the time I've been alive, I never saw a twanging string in space yet. Plum, like the Cajun says. Next slide, please. But then we never changed the models. We never changed the equations. What really happens? Well, we ignored, Maxwell ignored half of the energy and half the waves. Threw them out because it didn't know anything. You see, the electron hadn't been discovered at the time. Nobody knew there was a thing called an electron. The atom had not been discovered. The molecule was a formless blob. Everything was fluid dynamics. All they wrote was shaking fluid. They didn't write electron spin theory and nuclei of atoms and all of this. None of that stuff is in there. So what they had ignored the following. When I produce a disturbance in a transmission wire, what I do is I disturb the electrons up there. They wiggle, waggle, and precess sideways, and so do the nuclei. Now, the nuclei is a lot heavier than the electrons, but they recoil with equal energy, else I got to throw out Newton's third law. Well, they do recoil because we can measure that, and any physicist will admit that, but that isn't included in electrodynamics. Because now what happens? The electrons reach the surface of the wire and stop. In other words, they are embedded with this energy exchange in the surrounding ether or vacuum, and they shake the vacuum flux. If you're in quantum mechanics, they shake the zero-point energy if you're in continuous wave theory. Whatever they do, they shake up the troops in this space, whatever space is out there. That's what's perturbed. And at the same time, The nuclei, having positive charges, are going in the opposite direction, equal momentum, much less distance because they're highly damp because of the large mass, but they deliver equal amount of energy to the perturbation of the vacuum. So the vacuum, medium, whatever it is, gets a wave of expansion, the two pushing apart and the two coming together. That's what Tesla called his expansion rarefaction wave. It's just like a sound wave, and that's exactly what it is. It is an electromagnetic sound wave. But of what? What's shaking? I'm going to show you in just a moment. Next slide, please. Well, then comes along, because in electrodynamics, you see, we still assume the material ether. We still teach it at every university in the United States, including right here in Seattle. Never changed. Still in all the equations. Do you remember when your professor told you that at each and every point in space, there was a unit point coulomb of charged mass, there was a unit north pole of magnetically charged mass, and there was a unit kilogram of mass sitting at each and every point in space? Man, that's a lot of mass in space. You mean that empty stuff out there has got mass like that everywhere? And what the equations describe is how those unit masses and unit charges move if they were there, which they are not there. But they are still assumed to be there. So this shaking field, there's never been an electric field in a vacuum, never will be. This has been well known since 59, been pointed out before then, but accepted since 59. But it never changes electrodynamic teaching. There's never been an electric field in a vacuum. There's never been a magnetic field in a vacuum. There never will be, because they're force fields, and they require all those point coulombs and those point unit masses, and the Michelson-Morley experiment killed those dudes in the late 1880s. Killed them dead in a mackerel. And what did the electrodynamicists say? Now, I got sympathy for those fellows. I'm being a little funny, but I'm not really condemning those guys. They had a formidable job. There was only about three dozen of them in the world at the time. And what they said, fine, they wound up this way. Okay, if we don't have an ether, a material ether, we're not using one. They never changed a single equation. They never eliminated the material ether from the equations or the assumptions of the material ether. And every school in the Western world is still teaching that same old material ether that went down the tubes 110 years ago. Now, how long is it going to take our guys to change something they already know and admit is wrong? Another 100 years? Maybe. Next slide. Here's the definition, the way they define it. The field, the potential. The scalar potential. Common old voltage in the vernacular. It ain't even a scalar entity. 1903, Whitaker showed that it's just made of a bunch of longitudinal wave pairs. Hey, longitudinal wave pairs. A wave going one way and its phase conjugate going the opposite way. It's time reverse twin. It's anti-wave. Wave, anti-wave pairs. The thing is a multi-wave entity, and so a multivectorial entity. It ain't even a scalar entity. But it's called a scalar entity. Now, what is scalar? Is the amount of energy that an intercepting point coulomb is. If you stick one out there, it diverges the fluid flow around it. And so these waves all have to diverge around it, and the amount of energy in that divergence at that point is considered to be the magnitude of the potential. Ain't no such thing. They're the magnitude of how much energy is diverged out of the potential. They have nothing to do with the magnitude of the potential. By the way, let's reason together. If I have the tiniest of flashlight batteries and it puts out 0.25 volt and it puts out 1 milliamp, how much energy can I draw from that little bitty battery, the potential that's in that battery? How much would you like? Would you like 6 × 10^1,000,000,000,000 power joules? The formula, ladies and gentlemen, in ordinary electrodynamics is phi q. Phi is the potential. Q is how much collecting charge you have. And the amount of energy you can collect from that depends on how much Q you got. If you got a itty-bitty-bitty-bitty bit of voltage, just add enough Q, and every single bit of charge will collect its little piece of energy, and it'll just keep adding as you add more charge. So from any finite non-zero voltage or potential, you can, in theory, collect any amount of energy you wish to collect. And we are not allowed to do free energy? Oh, come now. Let us reason together. Next slide, please. So the fundamental definitions got wrong. Well, they got worse. They went from there to worse. Here's a common little old circuit. Remember, this was put together as fluid flow. Now, I'll come back to how much energy is really going here. There's about 10 to the 13th times as much energy flowing in this circuit as what we normally are taught to calculate in our university courses. And we'll show you how that got changed and thrown away. What we do is the electrons, we put a potential on the electrons. On the top wire, the potentials are higher, and so the electrons are energetic, and there's a more on the back end than on the front end, so that's a gradient, and that's an E field, and it pushes the electron forward. And in the model they use, where the electrons actually go ahead and travel on through the circuit, actually the energy pushes on down to the succeeding electrons. We go through the resistor, and they lose their little potential in the banging and clanging, and they shake off some fields we call heat. Now, when they get down to the bottom, they got none of those extra potentials left, like the Cajun says. They done exhausted all of that. They don't got nothing pushing them. So they're just hanging there like so much residue. But now your problem is, the way we're taught to build circuits, you got to push that little dude now that's hanging in the middle of your way all the way across that bottom line back to this battery here that I show on the left. And you got to shove him back up all the way through against the back EMF, banging and clanging and knocking the source particles every which way. Well, it turns out that half of the energy that's delivered to the circuit has to take him back up to kill the dipole. And the thing furnishing the energy is not the battery at all. It doesn't furnish nothing to the circuit. There's no work on the circuit at all. Sorry about that, but it's true. What the battery does is, when you, fools that we are, when we build this circuit and we run the current back through the back EMF, we destroy the dipole, which already we know from particle physics for 40 years has been pulling energy out of the vacuum and running it freely down the wires. We destroy the gusher that's furnishing the energy to run the circuit. We kill the gusher. Strangle that dude. And so what we have to do, the chemical energy in the battery then has to do some more work on some more charges to bring them back together and restore the dipole so it can pour out some more energy. And what we do is, we have a big old sumo wrestling match right there, and we kill that thing as fast as it forms. And since we kill it with half the energy that came out of the vacuum for free, the best we could ever get is half left in the circuit, and that's 1-to-1. That's 100%. That would be superconductivity. And so, damn fools that we are, we have to keep putting all the energy in there to get anything down through the resistor at all. And that's what we teach every electrical engineer in the country to do. It's really that simple. Next slide. We'll show you some more here. Now, boy, we have been trained now with very clever artwork and artful dodging to teach all our electrical engineers and many of our electrical physicists that power and rate of energy flow are the same thing. So when they talk about batteries furnishing power and generators furnishing power, power is not furnished to the circuit. Power develops in a component that's scattering something, like a resistor, for example, or changing the form of the energy. No generator and no battery furnishes any power anywhere. Now, energy, that's a different thing. But what we did, if you look at the energy flow, which was added after Maxwell by Poynting and Heaviside, Poynting, who got the name for it because he published in a prestigious publication, got the direction wrong and got the magnitude wrong by about 10 to the 13th. Heaviside corrected all that. So they use Heaviside's theory, which is what we teach today as Poynting theory, only we give it Poynting's name. And so what happens is, here's two wires, standard wires in a circuit or a transmission line. And this is right out of a standard garden variety electromagnetics book by Krauss, as a matter of fact. Actually, the energy flow fills all space around those wires. And I'm going to be in a perfect situation. I'm going to have these wires without none of them capacitance and without none of them inductance, you know, just for Gedanken experiment. And so all that energy is going to be going at the speed of light. Only a tiny, tiny tad of it, by the way, it reaches out to infinity in every direction. And these are the contour lines for the level of the power, as they call it, if you were to intercept it and use it at each point around there in those contours. This is right out of the standard garden variety book. Now, the only part that gets in the circuit is a little tiny part that strikes the surface charges in the wire. Remember what intercepts and directs energy and causes it to change and diverge? It's those little charges. And basically, it's the surface charges that get exposed to that little sheath right around the wires, or if it's a component, right around the component, and diverges part of it in there to power up the electrons in the circuit and form the J phi, which is the Schlepian vector. Now, what we have here is an embarrassment, like the Cajun says. Plum embarrassment. The reason is, if you calculate the energy flow out of this little old bitty circuit, maybe with a little old bitty battery powering it, it's enormous. Unbelievably enormous. And it reveals that we build the poorest thing in the world for electric circuits to intercept and catch energy and use it. I mean, I can't think of a word bad enough to describe how terrible the collection efficiency of our accepted circuits is. Think of the worst one you can and make it 10 times worse. You're still shy. Well, next slide, please. There was an answer to that. Get rid of the problem. You got a problem? Get rid of it. Sweep it under the rug. So Lorentz taught us a little trick. We put a little old closed surface cylinder right around that wire there, or some component, if we're looking at a component, and we iterate that pointing vector right around all that whole closed surface. And all those components that didn't hit nothing and didn't get diverged, they pass the same speed and the same magnitude and the same direction out the other side. It's a positive vector going in, it's a negative vector coming out, the integration cancels it. The only vector that's retained is the amount that hit the surface electrons got diverged into the circuit. So it'll match your instrument readings because they measure dissipation. They do not measure energy flow without dissipation. They measure only the dissipating component of the energy flow. It'll match your instrumental readings, the J phi vector. And that's what we teach as the energy flow in all our textbooks and in the literature. And the scientists are still discussing this. They've been arguing like gentlemen, that means debating very politely, in the American Journal of Physics alone, 30 years, about what the hell is the energy flow in the circuit. And most of them want to say it's the energy dissipation flow. And all our electrical engineers, if you look at what they call the pointing flow today, it's the pointing dissipation flow, only it's called energy flow, and it's totally fallacious. It's about 10 to the minus 13th of it. Isn't that odd? From every circuit, you got so much more energy filling the circuit around the circuit in space that you could collect and use, that if we had a Department of Energy worth a tutu de twat, that's a pretty good one, they would be doing this kind of work, how to collect more of the energy which is already there, and which if you go back and read Lorentz, you will find out it's there, and he threw it away. And everybody else just repeats the same thing he did. And they no longer even question it. The problem has never been energy. We have never built anything but a free energy machine. Every dipole in every generator and every battery is pouring the energy right out of the vacuum right down the circuit, and is poured in 10 to the 13th or so on the nominal circuit. It varies a little bit the size of the wire and all that. But a good nominal value is about 10 to the 13th times as much as that circuit itself intercepts and catches. And then us damn fools build a circuit which takes half of that and kills the dipole. That's how we do business in an energy system. And then we cry to you, to the taxpayer, we can't do any better. And the oil companies laugh. Well, the people that own the oil companies laugh. Because you've got to keep buying oil. Okay, next slide, please. And you will. We keep that meter on your car, at least the gas pump, and we keep it on your home. And going to keep it on there. Now, here's what Lorenz said. In effect, this is a little comedy sketch of what he said. If he was out on a sailboat and he was only catching the wind in his sail from a big wind on the ocean, he was in effect saying, none of the rest of that wind has any physical significance. That's the phrase he used back there. Except the wind that's in my sail. That's how stupid that is. So we add the next little slide to show that kind of graphically. Get a little chuckle out of this mess. You've got to make it humorous. You've got to keep your sense of humor. And we have him looking around at all these other sailboats somebody put in there, and he's saying, how the devil are they using that physically insignificant wind? Because there they are, you see. It's there if you want to collect it and use it. That's the main point. We are never taught to collect it, never taught it's even there. Next slide. I'm not going through that. If anybody's curious, that's the calculation. I couldn't find any calculation, although I'm quite sure Heaviside did it, but I can't find it anywhere in Heaviside's stuff. I must have missed it, but he did make this calculation somewhere. There's the calculation from a standard circuit right out of a textbook that gives you the 10 to the 13th figure. So, yeah, you can calculate it, and that's about how much energy in a nominal little old circuit you really got, and we only catch and use about 10 to the minus 13th of it. And then we use half of that to keep killing the thing that's pouring out the energy from the vacuum. If you built a water wheel like that, you would take a pulley on the wheel and put it back up attached to another pulley on the gate that swings out in the river to divert the flow down across the water wheel. And every time the water wheel started moving, the little pulley would start tightening the cable and start closing the gate. And us damn fools would have to go back up and keep shoving and working on the gate to keep it open. The energy's free, ladies and gentlemen. Never cost us anything. There's never been anything but free energy in every system we ever built. A charge, a single electron, a single proton is a free energy generator. It's a broken symmetry in that fierce flux with the vacuum. And I guarantee you that's a free energy generator. Particle physics has known it for 40 years. Don't write off little bitty things. Little bitty things got a lot of boost a lot of times. A lot more than we would give them credit for. They're the most powerful little critters on earth. By far bigger than your big dams and all that. Forget all that mess. In a human body, on a cellular membrane, you may have a distance of 10 to the minus 9th meters, a drop in voltage of 1 millivolt. The E field, however, is 10 to the 6th volts per meter, 1 million volts per meter, sitting at one little spot in the body. Now, that is a very strong E field. And you got lots of those little membranes. Well, what does that mean for a human body? Next slide, please. The human body puts out about 10, an average human body, and this is the calculation, puts out about 10 to the 15th joules per second of energy right straight out of the vacuum. That's all those little membranes and all those little drops and all that stuff and all those little charges in the body. It itself can only intercept about 10 to the minus 13th of it and collect to use. So it puts out 10 to the 15th joules per second. That would be watts if it were actually being used. It's just energy flow now. It's not being used. It catches 10 to the minus 13th. It catches about 100 watts to use, about enough to light a light bulb. And so the human body, which puts out that enormous amount of energy, is only captures enough to use about one light bulb's power's worth. And this is real. This is for true. The rest of the energy is non-diverged. Now, for you ladies and gentlemen here that study esoteric philosophy, everything from Qi, Chi, Prana, and all that stuff, I'm telling you in advance, Qi, Chi, Prana, all that is nothing but non-diverged electromagnetic pointing energy flow. That's it. That's all it is. Well, it's awful subtle. If it don't get collected and caught, it's awful subtle, isn't it? But if you had a system where you could collect some more of it, in that pass it made through your collectors,
could you not get some ordinary garden variety energy from the subtle energy? I'm translating terms between East and West. All I'm saying is I'm getting more diverged energy, which means energy that's doing work, from the previously non-diverged energy. That means subtle energy is not doing any work, no physical work. So I could get a lot more physical work. Now, do you know why you can bend and break metal if you get everything else just right? Or do you know how a Qigong master is able to run up on the wall and just stop about 20 feet up, hanging on the side of the wall, with his bare feet and his bare hands, not holding on to anything? Not many of those guys around, but there's still a few around. Do you know how the dance troupe, which Nixon brought over from China, which had three Qigong masters in it, was able to take a wood stave in this little goozle right here in your throat, which has no muscles on it, and two guys bend the oak stick pushing against his throat, and was unable to penetrate his throat? It was not a fake, ladies and gentlemen. You were dealing with a human being that spent his whole life in exercises to do one thing and one thing only: gather more of that energy and use it. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we could find a way to do that without having to spend 20 years of your life sitting on a mountaintop somewhere meditating to do it? That's coming. Next slide, please. Here's the Whitaker paper that's been ignored. Every little old potential. Now, these waves, although they move up and down, are not transverse waves. That's the velocity direction. That's not your amplitude direction. Excuse me. A single little common voltage, a scalar potential, decomposes into a harmonic series of bidirectional EM wave pairs, longitudinal bidirectional pairs. Now, I'm going to tell you a magic secret Whitaker didn't know. What is a bidirectional wave pair? Maybe I got a slide on that. Let's see if I got that on the next slide. Yes, I do. If I take one pair of that and look at it, when you add a phase conjugate, let me tell you something magic. If you don't hear anything else in this whole lecture, you listen to this. Record this, you know. Wake up the old attention bug and get it going. If you add a phase conjugate replica to a normal transverse wave, you convert it to a longitudinal wave. The way we model waves with the two lateral oscillations, X and Y, it can be either way or both or combination. What the phase conjugate does is lock that so it can't vibrate. The only thing left is the longitudinal direction. That's one of these waves here. That's the one that was inside the Whitaker, each one. If you phase conjugate this beast again, it locks the other direction, and the only thing left to oscillate in is the time domain. Now, the photon for this is known in quantum field theory. It's in Rider quantum field theory. Check it out, 1997, I believe. What you'll find is there are four types of photons. The first two are transverse photons, oscillate X or Y, or one can be in a combination. The third type is longitudinal. It oscillates along the line of motion. And the fourth type is, they call, a scalar photon. It oscillates in the time domain. Well, it is the most interesting of all, and we'll come back particularly tomorrow and show you some magic healing we can do with that, because when we want to time reverse a mass, we must pump with that wave right there. We must pump in the time domain. And we don't make longitude, we don't make time reverse waves then. We time reverse the mass that we're pumping at any frequency. Next slide, please. Think about that for an AIDS cell, for example, HIV virus. You time reverse every piece of the cell back to a previous state. Biologists would call that dedifferentiation. Physicists would call it phase conjugation or time reversal. End result is the HIV virus will no longer lurk in the cell. The real problem in HIV is the continuing infected cells that already have the virus's DNA in them, the genetic material. They become virus factories. You can get 99% of it, and the body does, but it doesn't get the other. And eventually that keeps changing and overcomes the body's defenses, and that leads to the eventual death of the patient. This way, by simply pumping the body with longitudinal waves, you can get every last bit of it out of there, because you time reverse every cell, including all of those infected cells. normal cell gets a little younger. Is that bad? Okay, so you lose a few some wrinkles on your face, like. Is anybody object to that? But the ones that were already infected will time reverse back to no HIV genetic material in them. And this was done in France, not for HIV. They didn't have it then. They didn't have the AIDS epidemic then in the 60s. It was done for cancer, done for leukemia, done for infectious diseases, and for arteriosclerosis. Next slide. Oh, excuse me. This is the one we want to use. Put that one back on. Whitaker 1904. This one was used. Showed that you can make every wave and every electric field and all that, any kind of pattern whatsoever, by the interference of two scalar potential functions. This was the beginning of superpotential theory. Other physicists have worked in this. Debye, for example, worked in it. McCrae, several other very noted physicists. And they went away from the scalar potential. They went on up to the vector potential and things like that. But it's a scalar potential that's very interesting because you can make everything out of common voltage, if you will, everything electromagnet, all the waves and everything, and you can make them at a distance. In that interference zone, you produce what we call today electromagnetic fields again in that zone. It arises out of the local space-time. It does not exist as wave energy at all on the way, except in these longitudinal waves buried up inside those scalar potentials. This beast will reach right through the earth and the ocean. It has very little interaction with mass in between. But out there in the interference zone, it produces energy. Now, if I bias my transmitter chassis positive, I will produce scattering energy out there, heat. If I bias my chassis grounds negatively, I will produce convergent fields out there, which is the definition of cooling. If you want to call that electrostatic cooling, that's fine. If I pulse this thing very powerfully in the negative biased region, I will produce a cold explosion at a great distance. If I bias it positively and pulse it very hard, I will produce a hot explosion. Several nations of the world have weaponized that. I will not discuss the weapons because we want to do for healing. Next slide, please. But those two cerebral hemispheres in your head are, in fact, two scalar potential generators and functions. And under just the right circumstances, they can indeed generate fields on the bottom and energy on the bottom, or convergence or cooling on the bottom of your feet. And you can, in fact, walk across coals because the heat is being cooled at your feet. And there are some folks in Japan who do this once a year as a religious thing, and they do not run across the 1,200-degree red-hot coals. They stroll sedately. And you can see it any time you want to go to that monastery that time of year and look at it. It's not hard to see it all. It's not hard to measure the coals. It's real. But you can't fake it. You can run out there with all the thoughts in your head you want to, and you just burn the hell out of your feet is what you'll do. The other thing is, did you ever worry about metal bending? Have you ever been to one of Jack Houck's metal bending parties? Anybody in here? Well, there's a few that have. Jack's a good scientist. Conventional scientist, but he got curious about the phenomena, and he gives these parties to see if people can't bend metal. He gets 80% of them on the average to bend metal. I bent metal. My wife bent metal. And now, the metal we bent was very simple. I held a knife, and she held a fork between these two pinkies, and I held it by the end. I did not have this on the knife, nor did she have this on the fork. And when everybody got in the right mood and things began to happen, all of a sudden, at exactly the same instant, her fork laid over and the tines began to furl around like that, and my knife laid over. And I'm holding it between these two little pinkies right here. And I defy any physicist to honestly do that experiment within the bounds, replicate that within the bounds of present theory. You can fake it like a magician does, deceive you to look somewhere else and substitute the fork or the spoon. But you can't do it on camera without any change at all. And I like to think of a special I saw some time ago in the South Sea Islands. of the amazing Randy watching the natives stroll sedately across the red-hot coals and shaking his head and saying, I have no explanation of that. That's on tape. Next slide, please. Oh, no, let's go into this one. This one's very important. Well, we're talking about all this energy and all that stuff. We never did really say what was out there in the vacuum, did we? We said there's no electric fields, and we said there's no magnetic fields. But the Cajun comes back and says, well, Tom, what in the hell is out there? You done got rid of the ducks. What else is left? So we said, we got a strange kind of them duck that Einstein dug up called them space-time. That's what exists between the transmitter antenna and the receiver antenna. Space-time, nothing else. But ladies and gentlemen, in general relativity, space-time is an active medium. The geometry is active. It acts on mass. Mass acts on it to curve it, as Wheeler said. And the curvature of space-time acts right back on that mass to produce a force on him and to move him. Space-time, when it changes, when it curves, is active upon mass at whatever level you take. As a matter of fact, it views all the forces being generated by the interaction of a little curvature of space-time on a little piece of mass. Every force can be represented that way. So what happens is, when we shake up these electrons and we eliminate from our thinking the fact that we also shook up the nucleons and the nuclei, the protons, but anyway, we agitate and curve the space-time. And what actually gets formed is an oscillation of space-time curvature, a pure general relativity wave. And what propagates through space-time is this propagating space-time curvature oscillation. Now, when it strikes the electrons down in the receiving antenna wire, being a space-time curvature propagation oscillation or disturbance, it does what such disturbances do. It works on the mass that it hits. And it oscillates those electrons. They can't oscillate longitudinally, so they move sideways, and we get our transverse electron wiggle waves in all our detectors. But the wave in the interim is a general relativity wave. So hidden inside electrodynamics has always been general relativity. And we never knew it. And it's a very powerful general relativity, far more powerful than our physicists go off chasing, particularly in astrophysics, because it uses the strong electromagnetic force is the agent of curvature, not the little old weak G-force. You don't have to have a humongous collection of mass. Now you can do it with little bitty stuff on the lab bench. You don't have to be out in the interior of a neutron star. All this stuff we're talking about in astrophysics can, at least in theory, now be engineered on the bench if we pay attention now to the general relativistic curvature waves that we can create and what we can do with them. Next slide, please. I want to be a little more exact on this for those of you that are technical. Basically, electrodynamics today, because of the still assuming the material ether, if I look at transfer functions, transformations, the equations are transformations from mass perturbation to another mass perturbation. That's all. They have nothing to say about what goes on in space-time. Nothing whatsoever. They are missing two enfolded transformations, shown in black on the left, matter to space-time transformation, where we produced now a general relativity wave of the oscillation of space-time curvature. And over on the right, when that reacts back upon mass in our receiver, it produces again electron wiggle waves. So we really go from electron wiggle waves. Electrodynamics tells us how the next electron wiggle waves will work. There's nothing wrong with that. It works fine. But it won't give you how to engineer what's in the middle. It'll just do it automatically, and that's it. You can't get refined in the art. But what actually happens is we put in these two extra functions. First of all, we made a perturbation in space-time. That propagated down to the other receiving antenna and reacted on those electrons to produce that transverse wave. So those hidden two Transformations are actually nothing but hidden general relativity, but the electrogravitation. This is the secret of electrogravitation right down on this slide. If you want to do anti-gravity, you're going to have to understand this in your head. Next slide, please. When you make forms of these curvatures of space-time, I use two names to speak of those. I took the names basically from other folks. They're not original with me. One is space-time curvature engines, because they act on mass like an engine would and do some action. And the other is vacuum action, because they twist up the vacuum. If you're considering that a vacuum instead of space-time, okay, you're in quantum mechanics, so what? You change all the particles, and you change the particle flux, and the density of the particle flux, and the direction of the flux, and all of that stuff. And it still has the same effect on the other end. One way you looked at it with wave theory, the other way you looked at it with particle theory. Same result. Now, the difference is this. If you receive a signal, and you are the receiver, you have some choice about whether you do that or not. He says, hey, Tom, I want you to leave the platform and go out the back door. And I say, hey, man, I ain't finished yet. I'm going to keep on till I finish, or they run me off on the rail. But if he sends you a vacuum engine, it don't say nothing to you about that. It grabs a hold of you and drags you out the door and throws you out in the street. You see the difference? One is the deliverance of a request. What I would like for you to do, if you would be so willing as to do this, and the other one is not just an order, it's an engine that goes in and grabs it and does the action. Isn't that nice? If I want to do stuff with matter, should I keep using signals? Well, maybe the matter, if I find how to trick it, maybe I can get it to do it, maybe I can't. But if I hit it with an engine, it doesn't have a choice. All I have to do is learn how to tailor the engine. Now, I'm using applied electrogravitation. I'm using general relativity, but initiated with the strong electromagnetic force as the agent of curvature. I'm doing something very precisely. Yes. What happened? So much of my work in the last years... I think he's trying to show that ship again from Mexico. And he's quite right. There are many, many sightings there in Mexico and many good photographs and many good videotapes. It's not just one. They happen all the time there. The only thing I can say about that is I am not knowledgeable, and I don't even want to be knowledgeable about who or what builds whatever kind of ships or whatever on this earth. That's not my job. I will say, in theory, I see no reason why one couldn't be built if one wanted to. Certainly, you can produce anti-gravity. The author of probably the only refereed paper, and that's a joke because we got it around the referee, in the literature that reports a successful anti-gravity experiment, where I'll show you that later, where we reduce the weight of an object on the lab bench 90% in controllable smooth steps. And this kind of thing is what we were using to do it. Next slide, please. Let's see, did we ever get that going? Or he's working on it. We'll keep going until he gives me a high sign. Basically, I try to represent here, and I'm not going to get wrapped around the axle about this thing, but basically, we now have two thoughts in our head. I have a piece of mass, and I have the structuring and curvaturing of the space-time involved right around it. Now, normally they fit like a hand in glove. But if I can change the space-time curvature at will and the patterning of it at will, I make an engine. And that will do to the mass whatever I wish to. By the way, I don't have to put any more energy in it the moment I curve space-time. From then on, space-time, which has got enormous energy, acts on it until it gets done, until they do fit like a hand in glove. Can you cure a physical disease? Yes. That's what time reversing a cell back to a normal state is. It's got a delta engine in it. And if you time reverse, make a bigger engine, it's an anti-engine, it'll back it right back along there to the previous thing that it was. Can I steer it? Yes, I put another engine in. I can move it off the trajectory. I can change it into something it never was, never had. This is very important. This is my extension to the priori work. And by the way, I filed a patent disclosure on this. I'm going to follow it up with a patent application. See, we can cure diseases for which we can reverse back to a previous normal state the body had with priori method by just perfecting it. But we can't take it back to something it didn't have. Potrozel, who worked with priori, did a beautiful experiment on that. He took immature rats, which have never yet acquired a normal immune system. He could infect these rats, and he could save them temporarily. He could back them up to their previous immune system, but he wasn't killing any pathogen, you see. He wasn't killing any organism. He's just backing that cell back up and its immune system back to its previous healthy state. But it hadn't been very developed or very healthy to begin with. Properly reinfested and killed it. But wouldn't it be nice if we could also, at the same time we're backing it up, move the immune system up until it was a healthy immune system, fully developed, and it could fight that pathogen off? And the answer is you can do that, but you have to add a second engine calculated for that. That's the way medicine one day will be done. You will go in with a disease or whatever, or just once a year, annual clearing you out, and making you reverse the aging you've had during that year. And you'll get moved back, and if you've picked up anything that was from your past, you had a genetic defect or something, then the computer will have to calculate an additional engine to put on there to correct that defect. I foresee well in the future the situation where a person born with a physical defect from birth on, has never had a normal body and never structure or anything, can be corrected with the right set of calculations and vacuum engines. By electrodynamics alone, but very peculiar electrodynamics. Next slide, please. Yes. Okay, here we go. Well, the willy wobble that you're seeing there would be normal in a fairly sluggishly responding servo mechanism. I'm not saying that's what it is. I'm saying it's consistent with that. If your servo mechanism has a little bit of delay, which all of them do, but it depends on how much, the amplitude of the oscillation before you get a correction for it will give you a sustained little oscillation. There's a phase lag in there. And what you would look like in a little wobble, you'd be looking at the phase lag in the servo mechanism for controlling a vehicle. That is consistent with that. That's all I can say. I don't know what it is. I've not studied that photo or anything like that, but it is consistent with that as an hypothesis. If that is a ship, then that's the lag in the servo system that you're looking at, probably. Next slide, please. Oh, no, we'll use this one. Everybody wants to know how to make a free energy generator that the scientific community will tell you for real is a free energy generator. Here's one, cost you 15 cents. Take a permanent magnet, take an electret, or if you prefer, just a charge capacitor, or a little battery, lay across it so the E field is perpendicular to the H field, and the common theory tells you that little sucker will sit there and pour out E cross H from now on. It won't run down. I didn't say you were using it to do work. I said you were producing the energy. The point is, it's no problem at producing all the energy you want. Energy is no problem. We live in a world so full of energy, it boggles the imagination. God has been very kind. He's really scratching his head how stupid we've been. He's got to have a sense of humor. I mean, he laid the greatest feast of all time. Everything we have, every electron in our body pours out enormous energy. And us fools are running around digging oil out of the ground. And burning hydrocarbons and polluting the planet and beating our head against the wall and saying, we can't get enough energy. Goodness gracious, we're wasting all but 10 to the minus 13th of it anyway that we get. So what we really need to do is change our head bone, like the Cajun says. Change our mindset. Change the models we're using, because the models are seriously flawed. Turn these young tigers loose in the young graduate schools. Quit setting on them. Let them go. They'll rework this stuff in about 5 years. You'll have all the energy you need, and you'll never have another problem. But you won't have any big oil companies either. So we reckon how far that's going to get. Not very far. But that is an honest-to-God free energy generator. It's a pointing energy generator. Now, if you want to work with that, you figure out how to collect and use that energy without killing the capacitor that you laid across that. And you will have yourself a free energy generator that does work. Next slide, please. Here's something I wanted to show for the people that like biological effects. Now, remember when we put an E-field or something like that from the conventional theory on a graph, it's really 10 to the 13th times that much, and it's really energy. It's not really a force field, okay? So we'll do a little translating here. But what we're doing is we show from the electrosphere to the Earth the normal so-called electric field between Earth and ionosphere. There's another one up between the ionosphere and the next layer up beyond it. The electrosphere, I guess it is. Now, this is the electrosphere. I'm sorry. From the electrosphere up to the ionosphere is the next one. And sometimes they are reversed. But crossed with the magnetic field of the Earth, this thing produces a continuous pointing energy flow around the Earth circulating from west to east. A very powerful flow, and it's 10 to the 13th times what they tell you in the book. But when you remember how you get a bum feeling? Very stuffy just before it starts to rain a lot of times, a thunderstorm comes in. Remember how bad you start feeling and aching and everything? If you got arthritis like I do, boy, the bones start acting crazy. Here's why. As the clouds move up, largely they're charged in the opposite direction. And the field you're in reverses, and all of a sudden every part of your body is getting scrubbed in the opposite direction. In other words, the big man upstairs is using a sort of like a plumber's friend on you. He's flushing out your whole system, you see. Well, that's very uncomfortable while that thing's going on. But when it moves off, because you've been plumber's friended from one end to the other, to every cell, boy, what a fresh feeling you get. And it's because you've had an internal cleansing. This is nature's way of cleaning out a lot of toxins and residues. And you get it every time there's a thunderstorm. Next slide, please. Okay, here's the pointing flow around the Earth, and about half the books get it wrong. And the reason is the North Pole is not a North Pole. The North Pole is really a South magnetic pole. It's where the North Pole of a magnet will point. And it was called a North Pole. Now, about half of them call it the North Seeking Pole. And you will have to do a rather surprising amount of work to run down the truth of which way that energy flows. Well, I spent about 6 weeks running it down, and that's the way it flows, right there. And I was able then to verify that with some folks that really do have the horsepower to know exactly which way it flows, and that's the way it flows, from west to east. Now, since you're nothing but a big electromagnetic package, and you're not, you're other things too, but I mean that's one thing you are, every move in your body that you have ever made has conditioned the potentials flowing through you. And they go not only just around the Earth here, they go to the ends of the universe. Every time you scratched your eyelid, blinked your eye, sneezed, whatever, permeates this universe from beginning to end. So does every flea. So does every virus. There is no place in this entire universe where there is not the analog of living systems. Everything from mind, intent, and everything in the potentials. Every potential in this universe, when it's formed, has that in it from the vacuum potential. What I'm telling you is the entire universe is alive. It may not be embodied, but it is alive. And by the way, there are ways to go in here and work with this and make it embodied. You can lift mass and mass forms from the Dirac C and from any part of the vacuum with vacuum engines, adding energy in the right fashions. And so in theory, at least, it is recoverable. There is no act that shall remain hidden. There's nothing you ever did or thought that is hidden. And for those of you that like to do spooky stuff, the statement is still true. If you go into the interior, the bidirectional longitudinal waves of the scalar potential, it's not possible to encrypt anything. You can get it encrypted for the fields, but the other signal is still in there too. You can't get rid of it. And so is every act we ever did, every thought, every human being that ever lived, every ant that ever lived. So my bottom line of this approach is that when Miller, Fox, and Urey were doing their biogenesis experiments, they were not doing them in the absence of living forms. The ghost forms for every form of life on this earth was flowing right through those little flasks all the time. And when you make a form in there, a little form that's resonant to those ancient protonoids, you will get the ancient protonoids formed. Yes, indeed, you do have biogenesis. And you can form any kind of living form, including a living physical human being, if you develop the science that far. There are certain groups, a few of them still left perhaps, they got wiped out by the Red Chinese pretty good in Tibet. But in one of the particular religious groups, to acquire a certain level of monk required the production of a living human being from scratch. Then you passed your exam, but then you had to get rid of it. You had to decompose it also, which took another 6 months. It took 6 months to form it and 6 months to get rid of it. So far as I know, there's never been but one Westerner go through that, and that was Alexandra Van Niel. It's a very interesting experience to read what she did in that particular order to actually create the mass and the emotions and everything of a human being and then have to get rid of it. But the universe is alive. I'm a Christian. I don't want to work my philosophy on you. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. That's not the intent of the statement. But I find it very comforting that there is no place that God and life is not. And I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Thomas. That is impressive, to say the least. You know, it's not every day that you get a quick course in how to engineer reality. And tomorrow we're going to give out how-to kits. We're going to lay the groundwork for tomorrow, which is going to be the specifics of some of the more outrageous ideas that you've heard touched upon this morning and this afternoon, and particularly this evening. Let me lead you off into this evening with an actual physical demonstration from ABC News. You can't get more mainstream than Peter or Good Morning America, of what Tom is talking about. There is a classic now experiment, so-called cold fusion, where a guy named Patterson took a bunch of specially prepared little beads, little plastic beads with metal coatings, and put them in a container, and he puts water in there. And I don't think in this experiment it's deuterium water. I think it's just ordinary water. And he runs two electrodes in. And the idea is that for some mysterious reason, which Tom now has elegant theory to explain, more comes out than goes in. Heat. Incoherent, randomized, scattered energy. And it pumps out something like, I think it's something like 1,000 to 1. I mean, it's some staggering output. 1 watt in, 1,000 watts out, something like that. They noticed at some point that something very bizarre was going on. And I'm not quite sure who did this, but they wound up putting a radioactive material next to the beads when the cell was in operation. And rather than me tell you, let me show you what Mike Gillian, my friend at ABC News, who's the science guy at ABC, who has the job I used to have over at CBS many years ago, what he reports, and that will wind up our afternoon. Hit it.
A little more than a year ago, we introduced you to an inventor who had come up with something getting a lot of attention. But its promise to transform our lives was tempered by the fact that it seemed to defy the laws of physics. But we got a tremendous response to that story that we did. Our science editor, Michael Gillian, is back with an update on this device and its creator.
Big time response. We get letters all the time about this guy. It's Dr. James Patterson. We introduced people to him about over a year ago. 75 years old, an inventor with 150 patents under his belt, including one for this little device, which he calls the Patterson Power Cell. It's really simple in concept. You have two electrodes here that you attach to electricity. You zap it with electricity all the while you flush it with salt water, Charlie. But at the heart of the power cell are those little beads. Can you see them in there? I've taken some out and put it on the plate, okay? These are these little beads. They're plastic coated with various layers of metal. There's a lot going on in those beads. And even though this device doesn't look like a lot, Charlie, as you're about to see, it's come a long way in the last year.
You got that one. You got that one. All right. Last year, when we first met Dr. Patterson, he was either out on the water fishing or in his old garage tinkering. Hard to imagine anything very earth-shattering happening here. And yet today, that old garage is a full-fledged modern laboratory. And Dr. Patterson is more optimistic than ever that his device will one day make fossil fuels obsolete.
We're getting nuclear energy output without the nuclear radiation byproducts.
Mike, let me show you a water heater prototype.
Oh, that's great.
3 years ago, young Jim Redding left Wall Street to market his grandfather's invention.
Well, here it is. This device is producing more energy than it is consuming. In fact, it's 50% more efficient than what people have in their homes today.
Well, this thing is really cool. All that steam out, when will this be available for consumers to buy?
We expect the device to be available from 2 to 4 years from today.
So right around the turn of the century.
That's what we are.
During the past year, Patterson's little beads have led to a huge surprise. Not only do they produce heat, turns out they also neutralize radioactivity.
This is the cell system down here.
It sounds like such an amazing development. The company is attracting big-name scientists like Norm Olson. He traveled all the way from Hanford, Washington, where the government stores billions of gallons of high-level radioactive waste.
This technology works out as advertised. It means we could significantly reduce the radioactivity of nuclear waste in the United States and the world.
But does it work as advertised? We decided to put it to the test.
What I have in this cup is radioactive uranium and a water bead.
That's what's sending that guy you're going crazy, right?
Yes.
So the idea is the radioactive material will then flow through your device and actually remove the radioactivity. I don't believe it. Go ahead and push the button. Let's see if it works. The experiment began at high noon, with the Geiger counter registering well over 300. But by speeding up the video, you can see that after only a couple of hours, the radioactivity was cut down by more than half, a reduction that would take billions of years to happen naturally.
I'm really encouraged at what I've just seen. Plan now would be to take it back to the Hanford labs to test it out under controlled circumstances and fully prove it as far as we can go with it.
I'm doing something very good for society. I'm accomplishing something for society. This kept me up early in the morning. In fact, it interfered with my fishing.
So you send electricity through the room, and these little beads produce more electricity than you send.
Yeah, 100 to 1,000 times more at its maximum output. But with this hot water heater they're developing, by the way, they partnered up with the world's largest hot water heater manufacturer. They're not so concerned about producing 100,000 times more energy. They're more concerned about it lasting a long time. So it's only producing about 120% more energy than it's consuming.
Is there something new?
I find it intriguing. You know, I'm skeptical in the sense, Charlie, that I'm curious,
I'm critical, but I'm not closed-minded. And what's interesting is last week they attended the American Nuclear Society, which is a conservative bastion of nuclear physics, and the device was very well received. They've been invited to next year's conference. Motorola, Westinghouse, the Department of Energy, all showing big-time interest. Southern California Edison, Long Island Lighting are all being tapped at their door. It's a story we're going to keep track of.
And Tom, yes? And tomorrow, Tom promises to explain how that works, how you collapse a half-life of 4.5 billion years into 1.5 hours. See you after dinner at 7 o'clock.
Thank you.
There is no place that God isn't.
No, that's true. The whole universe is alive. You're not going to get rid of the life. There's one thing alive anywhere, the entire universe is alive. So, they didn't do the experiments in the absence of life at all. Sure, they got created life in the laboratory, but it just condensed into the forms that were already there. It just changed the form. It's like, you know, in the Bible, it's like spirit activating matter. So to speak, spirit forms are there. I'm not using it in a voodoo-type sense.
No, right.
I'm talking about the actual form for the living intense of life. And if the other stuff has got the right form and the right resonance, it'll actually condense the forms that used to be on Earth, which is what they did. They had the conditions for that kind of form. That's the kind of form they got. Well, they've done those experiments, you know, over and over. They're standard now, but they think they were doing the experiments in the absence of life. You see, that's the bad thing. They think that this bolsters the view that life sprang accidentally out of nothing. It did not at all. No such thing at all.
Thank you.
Okay, very good.
I just wanted to shake your hand.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming.
I read an interview with David Mitchell about his days at Rand Corporation a year ago. The most significant thing to him was Geller could produce objects that were thin air.
Yes. Several other people around the world have done the same thing. And occasionally, emotionally upset teenagers occasionally do the same thing on a minor scale, but for real. I mean, not fictional. And of course, you know, the parapsychologists are still going around trying to investigate that. Occasionally they do find the cases for real. Not every case, you understand? Not every case is for real. But sometimes they do, and sometimes they can't explain it at all.
Well, Edgar Mitchell is a very reputable astronaut.
I met one lady that could generate a spark of electricity from her hand to your hand about 1 inch long. Well, that's about 25,000 volts, you see. And she could generate that on order, you know, hold your hand out, put her hand over your hand, and spat. You could feel it yourself, knock your ears off, you see. So, there's no way I can argue with that. She didn't have a battery on her somewhere to generate 25,000 volts.
How about the many reports of mentally ill people that are amazing?
Some are deranged and are. It's a very difficult area to study scientifically. The reason is our science is basically materialistic. It's based on materialism. And the models have frozen out the things that would give you the explanations for what's really going on so you could have a science of it. So the models tend to tell you this cannot happen according to our known laws in the model. What they're saying is our model don't fit this. If you can assure yourself that the phenomena are real, the experiment is real, the scientific method is to then take the experiment and let it tell you, or a series of them, what you ought to do to change your model. See, that's called a scientific method. What happens today, unfortunately, is they defend the model, and they defend it to the extreme. I'm not saying you should believe everything you run across. You know, certainly you shouldn't believe Amazing Randy. He's a magician, for goodness sake. But there are many other things we have not yet discovered in physics. Physics is not well known. My goodness, it's only about 300 years old, modern physics. What we would call the whole modern movement in physics. And so we've just scratched the surface. We haven't deciphered the whole universe at all.
So the point is that I think a lot of the young physicists now, for some reason, that pendulum seems to be starting to swing. And the younger physicists are asking questions that their professors just can't answer.
Over and over and over.